This is Monocle on Design, our dedicated weekly design show. I'm Josh Fennett. On today's show...
This is where all happens, you know. Milano has really succeeded in being the place to show great interior design. And I believe that it will be difficult for other international marketplaces to catch up or even come close.
Annual furniture fair Salone del Mobile wrapped up Sunday and clocked a record attendance figure. The fair itself may have disbanded, but for many designers and manufacturers, the very real task of totting up orders and heading back to the drawing board begins now. We bring you the interviews and a special report, with the highlights worth hearing from the designers and head honchos worth heeding from this year's fair. Plus, what can children teach professionals about design? We stop in at a London exhibition exploring the fast-maturing topic of design for children from the Nordics. All that coming up over the next 30 minutes right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24. Do stay tuned. Salone del Mobile, the design industry's premier event for flogging furniture, clinking glasses and eyeing up orders, wrapped up in Milan on Sunday, and the numbers are in. This year, almost 500,000 designers and manufacturers from some 188 nations amassed in the Lombard capital over the 6 days. But for designers, manufacturers, buyers and journalists, the act of ruminating on what they've seen, who they met and what lessons to take forward is just beginning. As ever, Monocle's team was on the ground and in attendance, meeting everyone from emerging talent to industry mainstays and deciphering the here-to-stay happenings from the fleeting trends. This show's producer, Daphne Karnesis, was there and brings us a roundup from her talks with luminaries including Michael Anastasiades and Patrizia Moroso, and brands numbering 3M, Cymatic, Panasonic and more. Take it away, Daphne.
Milan, the Lombard capital, a different breed of Italian city. One that, unlike its neighbouring cities to the south, where the debate tends to bounce between corruption, political scandals and red tape, the Milanese are a prolific people that look outwards, concerned more with attracting international visitors and talent in design, fashion and tech. It's the third largest economy in Europe after London and Paris, with some calling Brexit an opportunity for Milan to become a world city as it attracts creative businesses away from London. The city has always abounded with impressive art and architecture, and it leads the way with sustainable architecture and a futuristic skyline modelled by Zaha Hadid, Daniel Libeskind and Cesar Pelli, among others. This progress hasn't gone unnoticed, with tech companies like Google, Microsoft and Apple all setting up shop here in recent years. The Milan Expo, a six-month show with some of the best food around the world, held in Milan in 2015, was, despite fears, a huge success and is often cited as a turning point in the city's development. There's perhaps no other time when this momentum is more evident than during the city's annual Design Week, Salone del Mobile, or simply Salone, the furniture fair where buyers, designers, clients and journalists descend on the city to strike deals and showcase their finest work over 6 intense days. Exhibitors display their wares at the fairgrounds in row, while others opt for Fori Salone, the collective term for the off-site showrooms, galleries and other venues dotted across the city. Products range from furniture, lighting, new displays of craft and a plethora of big-budget installations, shows of light, colour and sound. It's also a way for brands that wouldn't necessarily have place in the fair to experiment. One of this year's hits that saw non-stop queues was an installation by H&M-owned clothing retailer COS in collaboration with contemporary artist Philip K. Smith III at Palazzo Zimbardi.
We're looking at my installation Open Sky, that is a collaboration with COS, and we're looking at 34 faceted, reflective panels that are arrayed in a circle at almost a 45-degree angle, actually a 43-degree angle, so that what happens is that both the architecture and the sky are reflected across the surface.
And it's not just larger companies that can put on a show. Designers get creative showing off their work too.
The idea was to highlight the historical pieces that we have in our collection. And based on the pieces that we've chosen from that collection, we've created these 5 different worlds. Each tent has its own atmosphere. One is, for example, a traveler on the Silk Road. Another one is a voodoo ritual experience, almost like a seance. Another one is a typical Italian beach camping scene. We have 2 rooms that are based on just the archive, so it's almost as if We've taken the fronts off of our packing crates and you're able to see what we have in our collection. Then we have a French beach scene, and then we finish up with a harem.
That was Britt Morin, partner at Milan-based interior design studio Di More, who aren't afraid of a little Italian eccentricity in their work. Plenty of parties scatter around the city, and while Milan's design districts from Brera to Tortona play host to these by night, the Fiera, the vast exhibition space northeast of the city centre in Rho, is where deals are struck.
The Milano furniture show, especially the Euro Cucina this year, is the perfect platform to introduce a new kitchen concept in the pure kitchen design of handleless kitchen, which SIMATIC stands for many, many years. So looking back to the 1960s is the first time when we introduced the handleless kitchen concept. In the 80s, there was a new introduction of that concept. Then in the early 2000s, and now it's time again to rethink pure kitchen design, minimalist kitchen design.
That's Ulrich Siegmann, the CEO of German kitchen designer SIMATIC, which has been in his family for three generations, known for its minimalist thin proportions and worktops. This year, he's part of the fair's biennial event Euro Cucina, which focuses on kitchen design. I asked him which market SIMATIC is seeing the most growth in.
The Asian markets, not only China that everybody is really talking about, but Japan, Korea, who's coming back really strong over the last two or three years, and the Philippines, for example, which we are doing very well in. So, you know, SIMATIC is trying to make a footstep on the high-end kitchen design all over the world, and there's more and more markets now coming up. Some smaller ones that have not been on our map over the years are, for example, countries like Vietnam, where we are opening a new showroom in Ho Chi Minh City within this year. You see some countries that are developing strong coming on our map, and others that have been there for many years are maturing in our market presence and in appreciating the design that we bring to the market.
And this year at Salone, it was the small kitchens too that had big plans. With urban populations worldwide only growing, our living space gets smaller and smaller as urban dwellers opt for good locations over large homes. A case in point is Japanese brand Sanwa Company, whose products are defined by smooth steel, ceramic finishes and functional ergonomics. And at this year's Salone, they unveiled eight new kitchens titled The Impact of Compact, including pieces commissioned from three award-winning Italian designers and architects. I had a tour of their stand, where they've even got a kitchen that doubles as a desk, with its smooth oak surface lifting to reveal a sink and electric hobs.
What we have is ACK. It's short for Adjustable Compact Kitchen. This is actually the product we developed from the winner of a design competition award. What's really intriguing about this kitchen is that it has a lot of functions out of necessity. It's also wall-mounted. And when you close this kitchen, it turns into a desk or a counter. Height can be adjusted up to like 19 centimeters high to make it to the desk's height.
I think this is one of my favorites that I've seen
Thank you so far.
Yeah.
That's Kajiro Serikawa, the manager of Sanwa Company's product design department. But the Japanese market isn't new to compact kitchens. So I asked them, why do they stand out?
In Japanese market, we have a lot of compact kitchens, but it's hard to find the one with design. And that's what we are trying to specialize ourselves in.
Furniture companies too, such as Italy's Casina, are adding perfectly sized pieces to their lineup. But walking around the vast exhibition space, what makes you stop at one stand over another? A beautiful eye-catching stand, of course. It can be just as important as the exhibit it's showcasing. London-based design studio Doshi Levine this year designed the stand for their client, the Danish textile company Quadrat. Here's Jonathan Levine.
So that the stand really is called Vertical Waves, and it really came from combining loops of fabric in the studio and seeing how the light fell on the fabrics and how it makes them shine and the colours really vibrant. And so we created an architectural scale of looped fabrics.
The duo designed their first upholstery range for Quadrat this year. So what are the unique considerations to take into account when designing textiles destined for furniture? Nipadoshi explains.
What's really important, you know, when you're designing textiles, especially for a company like Quadrat, where people use meters and kilometers of their fabric, is that how do you get a sense of texture pattern through texture and color? rather than pattern that's a kind of overt pattern. So for that, of course, you have to work very closely with the yarn construction. So in the case of Lila, for example, the fabric has almost like this boucle-like vintage Chanel kind of texture. It's a very luxurious fabric, and you imagine it more in the home. So when you're imagining a fabric for a home, for more comfortable seating, you can have a bolder texture.
And their inspiration comes from far and wide.
We travel, we look around, and then somehow all of those things that we're seeing and observing just percolate into our studio work. Nipa went to Beijing recently and started her collection of Chinese ceramics and brought back a beautiful selection of cups in these wonderful glazed colours. And Nipa's also been looking at 50s fashion, Balenciaga, Lanvin, and also
Indian miniature paintings from a Jodhpur palace, equally looking at Corbusier's painting.
Unique influences and inspiration like this should lead to equally unique and diverse products. Yet all too often, designs, particularly those that are trend-based, can become a little samey, as designer Michael Anastasiadis told me.
The most important thing is that everybody should focus in what they're good at and what they can actually say in a different way. The worrying bit is when people start copying each other, is when you realize that actually it has become a very saturated environment and is almost too many of us around. I'm never offended by this. I think the only thing that sometimes disturbs me with copies is they always change something. And suddenly the product loses completely its credibility. If they were to copy it in exactly the same way, I wouldn't have such a big problem. I mean, I'm not fussed by the idea that somebody can make money out of my own designs. What I'm disturbed by highly is when they change things in an ugly way that it becomes something you would never have done, but it still reminds you of your product. And it's almost like seeing the ugly side of yourself in the mirror.
This year's designs were undoubtedly dominated by colour, and some of the most packed stands at the fair this year were those with playful colours and patterns. It seems people have had enough of muted tones that come with minimalism and prefer more colourful creations, and that's the hallmark of Italian furniture brand Moroso. Monocle's Chiara Ramella asked founder Patrizia Moroso what she thinks of this rise of colour.
For us, colour is a normal consequence of design. And never was something to reduce to one, two colors because the market was going in that direction or because people is afraid of color. We are not. And our projects are always design projects. And color is part of the project for me.
And any examples?
Patricia wants delicate color, the Circhiola, for instance, or Nipa and Jonathan, Doshilevien. They love colors, they have intensity in their projects because she's Indian, so for an Indian lady, color is a very normal thing. So now I see that around, okay, finally color is rising again, I hope. For us, nothing is changing. We always use color with depending. If you are sad, you can use gray, okay, but depending on what you want to express. So for us, color is one of the tools of expression.
So what's at the bottom of people's desire for colour? What does it say about our society and people's needs?
My house, you can imagine, is full of colours, and I have joy from that. I have a yellow chair close to a turquoise sofa. In between there is something pink or whatever. And these colours make me happy, like when you buy a bouquet of flowers. So flowers as in a way the same meaning. You buy flowers because you want to have something nice in your eyes, in your table, and you look at the flowers and you're happy. Living in an ambient that is more, how to say, expressive can give you something, a moment of distraction from what is outside. Outside is bad, grey, dirt, you know, and you can have your beautiful ultraviolet house and be happy.
For the first time this year, Salone's organisers issued a manifesto called Milan at the Centre. It writes that the Salone should serve as a possible model for the rehabilitation of the Milan Expo 2015 site, which is currently being redeveloped. It also called on the city and design industry to promote innovation and sustainability. Just like the design industry as a whole, Milan attracts individuals who put design to the test to solve some of society's most important issues. But it's ultimately also a commercial fair, motivated on a basic level by the flogging of furniture. Drawing attention by creating a manifesto is one thing, but holding to this pledge and acting on it is key. On our part, we're already looking forward to next year. For Monocle in Milan, I'm Daphne Karnesis.
Sincere thanks there to our producer Daphne Karnesis, reporting from Salone del Mobile in Milan, which wrapped up this Sunday. Now, Japanese designer Oki Sato was at this year's fair. He founded Tokyo-based studio Nendo in 2005 and has been nothing short of prolific. He's currently working on some 400 different projects. One of Nendo's most recent collaborations is with the Republic of Fritz Hansen. Daphne met up with Sato at the Danish furniture company's showroom to find out a little more.
We designed a totally wooden chair, which is the first chair that Fritz Hansen has presented since the Arne Jacobsen Grand Prix chair, which was presented 61 years ago. It's been a lot of pressure for myself, but at the same time, it's a great honor.
So they approached you, and did they give you a brief, or was it quite loose?
It was 2 years ago here in Milan during the design fair, and I was showing 50 manga chairs, which was an installation very close to this showroom, just around the corner. And I was so exhausted after the setup and all the interviews, and I was sitting in the cafe right next door. And then a man walked out from the Fritz Hansen showroom and came beside me and sat down, and then we had a nice cup of coffee. And then he asked me if I was interested in designing the 51st chair after designing all these 50 chairs. Yes, I said, why not? And that's how it started. So it took us 2 whole years to present this. So it was an interesting moment for us, yes.
And now you've come full circle. You're back in Milan. It just shows how important it is to come to these events, also to meet people face to face, I guess.
Yes, I think the design fair has really changed the past 5-6 years, I guess, because before it was a trade fair for furniture, basically, and people were showing products, which has prices. But now I think there's more fashion brands, car companies, electronic companies as well. And it's a place to share ideas, to tell stories, and to meet people. And I think it's becoming not just a trade fair anymore. It's a place where we meet people, and it's a place to communicate.
Speaking of electronics, which you just touched on, I mean, you don't just do furniture. You're in a lot of different product categories. Mm-hmm. What role in all those sort of products does technology play for you in the way that you design?
Technology is kind of tricky in a way. When I design high-tech objects, I try to make them look not high-tech in a way. It has to look something that is in your grandmother's house almost. I think these things should look stupid in a way, because everyone's saying smart, a smart car, smart city. Everything's getting too smart for us. And I think that cars should look more stupid. Cities should look more stupid.
And by stupid, you also mean, I guess, simple.
Very simple, practical, analog. It should look like something that you've been living together with for a long time, I guess. I think that is one of the missions as a designer, to think about how to treat technology. It's almost like translating it into something that is much more friendly.
Can you give me some example of your products where this applies?
I have a solo exhibition this year at the Super Studio called Forms of Movement. So I'm presenting 10 new concepts together with 10 Japanese companies which have different technologies or techniques or materials. And one of the concepts is about printed circuit boards. And usually it's used inside of these electronic things, but I wanted to use this sheet of paper which is printed as a torch. So there's a checker pattern, but this pattern, it is like the route where the electricity goes through. And so when you roll this sheet of paper, the light goes on. And when you roll even more, the light gets stronger. So it works as like a diffuser as well. And so it's very difficult to explain how amazing the circuit board when it's printed using silver ink. It's very hard to understand for maybe small kids or for old people, but I feel that by making a torch, which is something that is within everyday life, or a sheet of paper that everyone knows, the technology gets much more friendly, I guess, in a way. And I think that is very important value of design as well.
Tell me a bit about your team and where you're based and how you work with your team in terms of your design process, creating prototypes.
Nendo is a studio based in Tokyo. It is a team of 30 designers and 10 management staff. We have 8 3D printers in our studio working 24 hours a day. And at this moment, I'm working on about 400 projects. And always I start from sketches. I'm a very bad sketcher, but I start from this bad sketch. And then we move on into renders and then into 3D printing mockups. We want to make this process very short because it's always important to touch and feel these physical mockups and to understand if the design is okay or not. We do a lot of prototyping inside of our studio, and whether if it's a small packaging for chewing gum or if it's a big building, the process is always the same for us.
How do you balance 400 different projects with, I guess, different lifespans and different production schedules?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think the fact that there's 400 projects creates the balance in a way. If there were only 4 or 5, maybe it will be unbalanced in a way. I think the most important thing as a designer is to forget the project, to reset your mind, to always to have a fresh way of seeing things. And when you have 400, you have to focus in one, and you have to forget about the rest of the 399, which really helps me as a designer. It almost drove me crazy because I've been designing this wooden chair for Fritz Hansen, which is a typical Scandinavian brand. And I've been working with 10 Japanese companies with high-tech materials and things like that. Also with Swarovski, with this glittering crystal luxury brand with fashion. And also I've been working on a collection for Minotti, which is a typical Italian brand. So trying to work with all these different cultures, different styles was a lot of work for myself, but it was really exciting.
That was Japanese designer Oki Sato, head of Nendo Studio, speaking to Monocle's Daphne Karnizis at Salone del Mobile. For more about the designer, do seek out our exclusive print interview in the May issue of Monocle magazine. Next up on the show, we exhibit a little childlike curiosity as we question the challenges of designing for children and ask what children can teach us about design itself. An exhibition at the V&A Museum of Childhood in London has grouped together some of the 20th century's most iconic and influential Nordic designs for children, from Lego to Marimekko, for its ongoing exhibition, Century of the Child. Monocle's Stephanie Sakia wandered down to the Red Brick Beauty in Bethnal Green to speak to the museum's director, Rian Harris. She started by asking why it was time to focus on the Nordics.
I think one of the reasons that the Nordic countries would have focused on this, I think, is because they've been, for most of the 20th century, very socially progressive in terms of their approach to children and childhood. This is reflected in the design that's produced for children, where children's needs have been placed right at the heart of that design. I think in Britain we're kind of slowly catching up with that, but I think they've been doing it for at least half the 20th century in those Nordic countries. I mean, they're all very different, and it's very unfair to sort of assume they're all the same. I think sometimes we do a broad brush stroke with countries like Denmark, Finland, and Sweden. They're all very different, but they do have a similarity in their approach towards children and childhood. That's very progressive approach about putting the child's needs right at the heart of their society. The Nordic Design Exhibition does gather together for the first time the 20th century's most iconic examples of Nordic design for children, and this has not been done before, and that's really exciting to have. We're the only London venue that this exhibition is being shown at, to have them all together for the first time. What's really interesting is you start to walk through the exhibition, you start to see examples probably from every middle-class home in Britain. You start to see the Baby Bjorn baby sling, you see the trip-trap chair that grows with the child, you start to see various examples of outstanding design that Scandinavia has been producing for probably decades that are now evidenced everywhere in Britain. The sort of, you see the wonderful colourful baby changing mat by Marimekko. It's interesting, it seems to have pervaded a certain sort of household in Britain at the time, and you'll see evidence of these objects everywhere. There's a simplicity about them, and that's why they've endured. It's why they're successful. As we merge into the 20th century, there is a particularly significant writer who, in fact, the exhibition's title comes from a book that she wrote in 1900. She's Swedish, her name is Ellen Kay, and she wrote a book called Century of the Child in 1900. And she prophesied that the 20th century would be the century when children would become at the centre of society. And we'd start to see childhood as a distinct phase of life and a distinct time that had its own customs and habits rather than simply a journey to adulthood. and needing therefore children's rights, creativity and freedom to be acknowledged and respected, and particularly their right to education, and for that to be upheld in a particularly kind of free and playful way. So some of these objects aren't exclusively designed for children, but they're slightly playful. But they're in the V&A's collections, and they're from the sort of 18th and 19th centuries, but they give you an idea that you might see some of the traditions that you see in previous designs, actually the use of natural materials, the use of colour, that actually, or very simple design, that are echoed right through to the 20th century. So even though people think of, I think, contemporary Nordic design as being very stark and very different to previous centuries, it actually does have remnants of that kind of modern and traditional kind of combined together by the use of natural materials, the use of simple clean lines and sort of simple ornament, but also really extraordinary colour to it, and slightly anarchic as well as being very clean and simple.
Well, I think also that the folk art of those regions is very much, you know, working in primary colours like red, blue and yellow, and these really bold sort of floral patterns, which of course we don't associate with the very clean minimalist lines of Scandinavian furniture today, for instance. But I see what you're saying in terms of how we see those very simple, bold colour schemes manifest in children's design around the world today.
Exactly. What you do start to see, I think you'll see it in Nordic designs particularly, but I think you'll see evidence right across the Western world, where you get that combination, that idea of primary colours being associated with children. I think that's sometimes a little bit cliched, and actually I think, you know, really good design for children should incorporate all the colour spectrums, and you start to get these variants between sort of subtleties of colour. But yes, if you go to lots of children's play centres, they tend to be primary colours, so yes, absolutely.
I know that Nordic ideals of the welfare state are manifest in design for children, and of course the Finnish baby box programme has got a lot of attention in recent years because it's the idea that every child deserves an equal start in life.
I think the Finnish baby box, which we have an example of in the exhibition, which was first established in 1937 when the welfare state was set up, but I think wasn't widely available until the 1940s, is actually one of my favourite things in the exhibition because it's gender neutral, it's beautifully designed. The wonderful kind of eco-friendly cardboard box that it's in, that's very prettily designed, can double up as a cot. And then it has all the things that you might need when you first have a child and give a child the best start in life. And I just think it's sort of evidence of how civilised a state is by saying that every child is deserving of this start in life, regardless of background, where you come from, what kind of income you have. It's applicable to everybody. It was means tested for a period of time. Now it's applicable and anybody can apply for one of these baby boxes. But it's kind of evidence also of how a state nurtures for the most vulnerable in society, in the way that we are. So if you are caring for children, you are making a statement that we are thinking about the future, where our future children are our future, by giving them this extraordinary start in life. And it just feels to me that sense of how magnanimous some states are in the sense of thinking about children this sort of way. But what's really interesting is Scotland has introduced one of these boxes in 2017. So they are now taking up this initiative, inheriting that from the Nordic countries, from Scandinavia, and actually using this as an initiative to think about being progressive about their care of children. You know, if you look at these gorgeous cots.
It's Icelandic.
It's Icelandic, and it's incredibly beautiful. It's interesting, if you start to look at it, it's a simple birch plywood structure. It almost could be like a nest. It's on elongated, slim legs, so it almost does feel like it could be like a bird's nest in a tree. And the idea was is it would take up less space. So there's always usually a practical, you know, it's that kind of form of function, I think, with Scandinavian design. It's not all about making it really pure and simple and beautiful, which it all is. It actually usually has a kind of functional element right at the heart of it. So for example, with this cot, you could start to understand it was designed to protect the baby inside, so it feels like an enclosed nest. But also it can take up less space because the legs are very slim and it would be able to slot in into a variety of places. So it's those two things working together. But the simplicity of the design, the use of these natural materials, I think are really attractive to a wide range of cultures. And I think that's partly why they've endured and why they're used.
I suppose in many ways children are the perfect demographic to design for a certain school of design, in that, you know, they're interested in the object serving more than one purpose and doing so in a very straightforward way, which can clear the head in a wonderful way if you are a designer.
Indeed, and I think that one of the strengths of Nordic design is that they have tried to put children's needs at the heart of the design, rather than that sort of top-down version of design which can exist, where we, you know, sort of adults think they know best, and they're designing something that they think from an adult perspective, which children then probably turn upside down and use in a completely different way. I think what Nordic designers are trying to do is to respond to actually what do children want, what are their needs, why do they want this object to come apart, why is it a chair that actually I can pull apart into three pieces and turn it into something else. It's following children's natural instincts because they want to explore and play, break things apart, put things back together again, and to explore and discover. And that's part of how they are learning and developing in the world. And it feels like the core of the kind of design we're seeing in this exhibition is responding directly to those children's needs. And what I particularly like is people, again, in Nordic design, is you get this huge amounts of simplicity, raw woods, very simple shapes. But then you also get this slightly anarchic element. So you get this, you know, really crazy colour that you get from people like Marimekko, or you definitely see in the Moomins as well. There's another complete element, I think, to Nordic culture that's slightly maverick and anarchic that starts to come up with these extraordinary explosions of colour and these slightly sort of unreal worlds.
What are the challenges that childhood faces over the course of the next century?
I think it's going to be many, and it depends on which childhood you're talking about. Childhood is universal, but it's incredibly diverse. We're talking about a whole world here. So are you a child that's based in Britain, a child that's based in a Scandinavian country, or are you a child based in Syria? So I think we need to think about what we mean when we say that, I think, to make the point that there isn't just one childhood out there. Perhaps if we're looking at childhood in Western society, which I assume is what we're discussing here, I think one of the things we need to think about is their whole approach to technology. I think the digital world is the way that they communicate with each other. It's the way they embrace the world. It's the way they learn about the world. And I think that's going to be increasingly so. And how they experience the world is going to be partly through a screen. And how that adapts into the future is going to be interesting to observe.
That was Rian Harris, director of the V&A Museum of Childhood, speaking about the exhibition Century of the Child, Nordic Design for Children from 1900 to Today, with Monocle's Stephanie Sakia. The exhibition runs until early September. Next week, from an emerging British brand intent on reviving the Windsor chair to the future of Savile Row tailoring, plus a leaf through the archive at Liberty's department store, we talk to the folk shaping British design today. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.